callers, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your main host for today, Tegan Marshall, here with Brandon Brownlee, Mihai Kovacer, and Aaron Wang. Last week I did an introduction to what existentialism is. For those who weren't here, here's a basic overview of existentialism. Existentialism focuses upon three main tenets, which is nihilism, or the idea that life is somewhat meaningless, engagement, engaging with the world and phenomena around us, our very existence, freedom, authenticity, and ethics. So, how do I bring those all together? I bring those all together by talking about how existentialism is the search to understand and derive meaning from our existence. Jean-Paul Sartre said that existence precedes essence. That is a fundamental shift in the philosophical discipline of the 20th century, because up till that point, the commonly held view, by and large, was that you had an essence to you that preceded existence. Now your very existence, because it's undetermined, you now get to derive your essence. So with that in mind, this series is going to be focusing on a number of existential influences. Soren Kierkegaard, Friedrich Nietzsche, Martin Heidegger, Martha C. Nussbaum, and Thornton Wilder, in particular, his work entitled Our Town. Now that you're relatively caught up to speed, let's jump right in. So, today for you guys, tonight when we're recording this, we are talking about Soren Kierkegaard and Friedrich Nietzsche. Who exactly is Soren Kierkegaard in relation to existentialism? I'm glad you asked. The answer is, he is considered the grandfather of existentialism. He was one of the first in his time to really focus on the individual and their relation to society, being critical of the way that people were just kind of, you know, following the leader, not being attentive to how they were living their life, and seeking meaning from that. And I have a colleague with us tonight, Mr. Mihai Kovacer, who is a gifted student of Kierkegaard in his learning. He is passionate about his writing, so he is going to assist me on the Kierkegaard portion, and then I'm gonna embrace my individuality and run with Nietzsche through the city. We'll get to what that means in a second. But Soren Kierkegaard is important because, as I said, he is one of the first to really create a philosophy around authenticity, around awareness of one's own mortality and how that influences our actions, how that influences the way we see, treat, and respond to people and situations.
So I do have one question regarding essence and existence. So in my little bit of reading to prepare for this show, I found an article from Stanford, and it was speaking kind of the changing relationship with regards to truth. So right. Existentialists do not really hold the previous ideals that Western traditional philosophy has normally used, a methodology grounded in rational detachment and objectivity, and instead they come to an idea of subjective truth rather than objective truth. So is that related to the essence existence
yes.
distinction
yes.
or is that something different?
That is definitely related in the sense that the essence preceding existence comes out of the belief that there is some objective human nature. That is rejected in the existential tradition. To say there is no nature that is thrust upon humanity, rather it is a shared condition that we all have, right? Because for there to be a nature that is thrust upon humanity, there must be some entity above humanity of which to thrust it upon the human race. So for the existentialism and the rejection of God, which we'll get to in Nietzsche this evening, that doesn't apply.
I think Kierkegaard is a very fun author to read and to talk about. And I think the reason for that is the way he tackles individuality and faith in particular, it's tough to get the mind around at first, but it's a lot of fun once you do, I think. A way to describe Kierkegaard very concisely, it's, I think, the opposite of Hegel. I don't know if any of our audience members are more familiar with Hegel, but I'll explain exactly what that means. So Hegel, he was a champion of reason in his thinking. He was a champion of reason being what is real and reality being reason. I think there's an exact quote on that that I'll find at some point for you folks. But it really is a matter of seeing reason as... the rational is the actual, and the actual is the rational. That's the quote from Hegel. And Kierkegaard hated this. Kierkegaard was very much more along the lines of the lyrical, let's say. And he hated modern at the time. This is 1813 to 1855, I believe. So, you know, early 19th century. He hated Christianity at the time because, as Tegan said, it really became a matter of follow the leader, a list of ethical rules, literally commandments at the heart of it, that people had to follow in order to be ethical. And to Kierkegaard, this was complete nonsense. To Kierkegaard, the only way that one could achieve real ethical living, the highest truth, was it had to come from within. You couldn't be told how to act ethically. And this is where it starts to get a little bit more abstract here, but if you'll bear with me for a moment, I think I can explain it fairly briefly. In essence, Kierkegaard is... So there's a quote of his that I have here. So the real subject, writes Kierkegaard, is not the cognitive subject. The real subject is the ethically existing subject. So first of all, the ethical side of things was the most important. And the difficulty of becoming ethical, in Kierkegaard's view, is you had to embrace that which was beyond reason. So faith to him and ethical living was beyond logic and reason. And the best example of this is in his Fear and Trembling, when he uses the example of the binding of Isaac. So for those of you, again, that are unfamiliar, in the Bible is a passage where Abraham, of course, is leading his people through the desert. And at some point, very late in his life, he has his son that he'd been wanting for so long, Isaac. And at some point, he is asked by an angel of God to take Isaac to the top of the mountain and to execute him there, then and there. And this is what we call, I think I've talked about it in a previous show, actually, which is why Aaron is smiling at me. This is what we call the teleological suspension of the ethical. So ethics, the way we see it today and the way a rational sort of school thinker like Hegel would see it, there are ethical standards, there are ethical actions. But to Kierkegaard, there is an aim, a telos, right? An aim that is greater than all things ethical, that sometimes you have to follow to really have a life fulfilled in faith. And so sometimes you suspend the ethical in that name. And so when God asks you to kill your son, not only is killing your son and killing anyone with it in cold blood a immoral act, I think most people would agree, but it's his son that he's wanted for so long. And so that's why Kierkegaard called this piece Fear and Trembling, because that's what it causes in a person to have to suspend his ethical standards for something else, something more, according to Kierkegaard. So to tie it back to our sort of existentialist discussion here, the ultimate truth for Kierkegaard comes from that dive within that one takes, and you come out from that understanding that the individual is the single unit of value, of value producing unit that exists truly, and that any attempt to formalize or rationalize the ethical and faith experience that's different than that is just wrong on the face of it.
It is valuable to realize the stages of life that Kierkegaard observes, how one comes to a life of faith, what that looks like. That's not some instantaneous change for Kierkegaard that takes place. And the recognition of the introspective search of the human person for Kierkegaard reveals kind of three stages which lead to the leap of faith, which then causes you to as Mihai has stated, have the teleological suspension of the ethical. If you want to sound famous and popular, try throwing that word out at a dinner party, see what comes up. But the three stages he sets out, it is the life of the ascetic, that as we begin to explore life and build relationships, we respond out of a fear of punishment. So we are often reserved. We don't rock the boat too much. We just try to survive, and that is a lonely existence, right? That is an existence devoid of meaning, devoid of community, and just full of anxiety. And so as you grow, you then start to utilize reason and rationality, and so you journey towards the life of the ethical. The life of the ethical is wider, is a little more freeing, because you're able to be like, what is the ethical response to X? What is the ethical response to this situation? But you are still fundamentally alone, because that ethical experience is fundamentally based upon your own ethical code and conviction. So finally, you have to enter this suspension of rationality. You have to take the leap of faith, which, as it was described to me by one of my professors, which leads you to the life of faith, which is an emptying of yourself, to be infused with divine grace. And in that encounter, in that infusion, you find community, because there's a group of people united to something that is bigger than they are. Would you say that's a correct summation there, Mihai?
Yeah, I will note that, and this is probably, you know, fairly close to what you were talking about, but there's another quote here that I will just find for you. So he says in that piece, Fear and Trembling, he who has a real respect for himself and concern for his soul lives alone in the world. And I think to Kierkegaard, I would almost venture to say that the communal aspect of it, the communal living and living with others, is at the end of the day less important than it is to really discover yourself. And the thing about that is, faith, this is why this is such a, it tickles my brain to think about this, and this is why I love Kierkegaard so much, is he is asking no less than for you to take an impossible position. He is really saying that faith is confronting the modern rational authority that people have built up around religion, around ethical living, around all of this. And as you say, Tegan, it's a sacrifice. You have to sort of void yourself of of that authority and of your own ego to really embrace the faith that he is describing. And he describes faith by that struggle, that it's really the struggle to occupy a position of impossibility. And I like the term leap of faith, because I had another prof describe this as like walking along the edge of an abyss, where that abyss is unknown. It doesn't make sense. It's not rational. It's scary. And at any point, you may be asked to drop off into that abyss. But at the same time, when you live your life and you embrace that fear and move beyond that fear to being okay with the idea that you can't understand faith, really, you walk that line with confidence. And that's what living in faith is to him. And to bring it back to our topic of existentialism, as you say, he really is the grandfather of the school of thought, because this is completely different from the communal, rules-based, organized living that we still embrace today. It's a completely different way of looking at yourself. It's feeling this irrational, strange faith and finding joy in it at the end of the day, and understanding that that's all within you and you are the most important unit. And that's why, so I would say that communal living part really doesn't feature as much if you live a life that's really concerned for yourself, as he says, and for your own soul, because to each person, that's the subjectivity part of it. Is it? It's all subjective to each next person who goes on that same journey. But I would say that, you know, it wouldn't be a stretch to say that you could find other people who have really done that for themselves and have a sort of connection to them in that respect. But it's scary. And I think that's what scares people about existentialism too, you know, it's because that's the foundation of it that Kierkegaard laid. It's a scary thing. And it's a thing where you have to suspend some of your most deeply held beliefs in favor of something completely different.
And as Mihai has noted, I will open the floor for my colleagues in a moment. But as Mihai has noted, existentialism for Kierkegaard has a very sacrificial nature. You must be willing to embrace the unknown, because it is from embracing the unknown that you then discover who you are, both because of and in spite of the fact this is an idea that later existentialists will run with, to see the unknown as possibility, as Martin Heidegger would define it, to see the ability to be in a moment and to learn from it, as Nietzsche would talk about in the heaviest weight parable, right? All these different images, all these different authors write about the sacrificial nature of existentialism, that we have to sacrifice the structure to encounter who we are, who being itself is. And I think I want to throw this question out to the group. That is, if they have no additional questions, is how would you respond to as you heard, I listed off a bunch of qualities earlier: authenticity, ethics, right? All these different qualities that existentialism is known for. But perhaps we need to add an additional one, and that is mystery. To seek to understand the mystery of life, because that seems to be, in a lot of ways, how Kierkegaard himself defines faith, as a mystical, mysterious phenomenon, as a way of living, So I'll turn the floor over to my colleagues, and we'll see where we go. Mr. Brandon.
Yeah, so I think that's a good direction to take Kierkegaard's thinking in general, but it also kind of anticipates one of the questions that I was thinking of when I was listening to Mihai's explanation or kind of exegesis here. And it seems to be that with the teleological suspension of the ethical, because I'm trying to, my intellect, my reason kind of bumps up against a wall here. I ask, okay, well, you give me this injunction. You have to go into yourself and you have to find out, you know, what your sort of subjective truth is. But how do I do that? What does that look like? And the thing I think this is a symptom of me understanding you is that Kierkegaard is actually foreclosing on the possibility of answering that. He's not saying, okay, there's some, like, once you go in, you have to, you know, it's like an Orphic thing where ignore the pool of Lethe by the cypress tree. You have to go to the other fountain or anything like that, you know? He doesn't actually give it to you. You are told you have to do this for yourself, and then you are left to figure out what that even looks like. That, I mean, it might even not have a methodology to it. It might just be spontaneous. It might be contingent. Something might just happen to you. These all seem like possibilities opened up by Kierkegaard. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, there's another quote I want to bring up here. It comes after the God's command to Abraham, and he writes, "The problem is not to understand Christianity, but to understand that it cannot be understood." So it's exactly as you're saying, the subjective nature of it and the sheer absurdity, because let's acknowledge that for a second. It is meant to be absurd. It's a reductio ad absurdum right to the very core, where down to the very core level, you are asked to forego any sense of logic, any sense of trying to piece this together beyond the feeling, the subjective feeling that's going to guide you to a life of faith. And it's being, I think it's acknowledging that and embracing that and living despite knowing that you might have to sacrifice, for example, ethical standards or rational standards to get there at any given moment. I think that's more about that process than it is about any series of steps that gets you to a final destination, which is why I think it's fun to try and understand this, to understand his explanation, right? And he goes on to say, so this is the knight of faith, right? This figure that he describes as going on this journey and ending up in faith. First of all, you have to be okay with being alone, because you will appear insane to people. You will not be understood by people when you start breaking these rules for no apparent reason. So that's part one. But the other part is that you're going to take a certain, quote, take delight in everything you see, because, quote, finitude tastes just as good as to one who has never known anything higher. So in a sense, you'll take delight from the freedom of the temptation to run with the crowd. So you have to be alone and be okay with it, and then you'll find a certain joy in that. And I think people can understand this, especially if you've read anything about Eastern traditions, about Buddhism, for example. It rings a couple of bells in that respect, right? That solo introspective journey, hero's journey, right? Where you become misunderstood to other people. It has a lot of those elements, which is why people don't want to do it, because they don't want to be alone. And that's the hard thing about existing existentialism, according to Kierkegaard, is that that's ultimately what it is. But I did want to pass it off in case Aaron also had something to add or a question or something like that.
Yeah, I've definitely been enjoying the discussion. I'm very much tempted to get into some of the details of the argument, but I think that might take us a little bit too far away from existentialism. The binding of Isaac and the story of Abraham is a very, you could say, controversial thing to base your philosophy in. I'm reminded, for instance, that Sam Harris, a famous proponent of atheism, has stated that it's basically this type of decision illustrates how irrational religious people can be and how that's a severe problem. So there, I would say that it's a very controversial position in some circles to say that we can disregard rationality in favor of pursuing faith for our own ends. I mean, I'm not, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a bad thing, but I would say that it's a rather controversial position in the modern day. And I think we need to recognize that.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the reason for that is I write this in a paper of mine that I was talking to my colleagues about just before we started the show, but it makes it really hard to have progress when you're expected to be alone and unable to understand or communicate with other people who are all on their own subjective journeys. And this is where, as much as I love the Kierkegaardian sort of thought experiments, this is where I sort of veer off from him, because I don't like the idea that each person can claim a subjective truth and then my question is, where do you go from there? Right. If each person has their own subjective truth, it might make sense if you're talking about identity and like figuring out your own identity, who you are. Of course, that's individual to each person, and that's valuable to really know yourself before you come into the public sphere and start talking to people about your ideas. You have to know your own ideas first. But if that's all you have and you reject other sort of common ways of interpreting reality, right? Facts essentially and rationality that everyone can agree on, it starts to become a bit of a problem. So I'll concede that, Aaron.
Well, I will not. I do not concede. I do not pass go. I do not let Aaron collect $200. He has lost the game of Monopoly. He has lost the existential journey.
All right. Well, then let me play devil's advocate for a bit.
Okay.
You got
about 30 seconds.
Yeah. So if we take this from the perspective of Abraham, and we take this from the existential perspective, then the story goes something like this, that Abraham is someone who's called by what he hears as a voice of God. And this is the biblical narrative, which is not necessarily historically justified, but it's probably what Kierkegaard is drawing on in this case. So he goes, he hears this voice of God, he obeys it by what the text says is faith, and he follows it out into the wilderness. He goes on this long heroic journey in which he has promised many descendants. And because his wife is barren, is unable to conceive a child, this is problematic. Isaac is the result of this journey, is God's promised heir to Abraham. So for Abraham, from the existential perspective, God has given him, you know, the meaning in his existence. But then God commands him to kill Isaac, which is essentially God saying, I'm undoing this promise. Now, what's interesting is for followers of the Christian tradition, there's another passage in the biblical text which explains this, which says that Abraham had faith that because he had previously promised Isaac as his descendant, he also had faith that God would raise Isaac from the dead, even if Abraham killed him. So that the essential proposition there is not that, I would say, is that Abraham suspends his ethical beliefs against not killing people for the sake of his faith in God that he is able to raise the dead to life. So whether, and I know this departs from kind of our subject matter of existentialism, but whether or not that type of religion